You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Although he's been pretty much forgotten, H.L. Humes was a prominent figure in American literature during the 1950s. He was the co-founder of the Paris Review and the author of two highly acclaimed novels, The Underground City and Men Die, both out of print for nearly 50 years. But they are being reissued by Random House this month. Joining us now is his daughter, Emmy Humes, whose film doc chronicles her father's life as a hipster, visionary neo-prophet. At least that's the way Paul Auster once described him. Doc will be playing at the Film Forum beginning tomorrow and running through the 29th. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your father was a complicated man who lived a complicated life. Did you make this film in hopes of understanding him better?
You know, I think I made this film in hopes that I didn't have to explain him anymore. You know, or to try.
People kept on asking you to explain it?
All my life, I had the most difficult time. I mean, you know, a friend would say, oh, you know, what does your father do?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, is your father alive? Or anything about my father. And it was always just sort of, it was a poser, you know. I never knew exactly what to say. And I'd start explaining, and then the explanation would get longer and longer and longer. And I think that, you know, something that I find difficult to pin down is a good subject for a film.
Was he around much when you were growing up?
Well, not for me. I mean, I have two older sisters. He was around more for them in their, you know. I have these very sharp snapshots of him. He was sort of, you know, a celebrity father who came in and made great appearances and sort of memorable, wonderful moments.
So if your sisters had made this film, would it have been a very different film?
Goodness, that's a great question. I mean, we'll have to... I don't know.
Well, what was their reaction when you told them you're going to make this film?
They've been incredible. I mean, I have four... Well, I have three other sisters by my father, and they've been incredibly supportive through it all. But yeah, I'm sure... I mean, we are united in this kind of forgiving, I think, pretty forgiving attitude towards him.
Mm-hmm. There is another child from a college kid, which we'll get into later. Because he suddenly started hanging out with people as old as his own kids.
Yeah.
Well,
he came to college with us, basically.
Why was he called Doc Humes?
He won his nickname Doc when he was in high school. I think it was from a Buck Rogers cartoon, comic strip character named Doc Hewler, who was a sort of brainy scientist type.
And so people thought he was brainy and they called him Doc?
There's some story about Doc. You know, there's a whole mythology about Doc. And one of the legends is he corrected his math teacher or science teacher in Princeton High. And, you know, the teacher took offense. And then it turned out the next day that, you know, he had to apologize. And anyway, so he was called Doc since he was a teenager and it just stuck.
Most people will tell you that George Plimpton was the sole creator of the Paris Review. But... how did he get written out of that history?
Ah, well, I mean, Doc was the very, you know, the instigator, I call him. He was the instigator of the Paris Review. He had a precursor publication called the Paris News Post for a couple of years. And, you know, the way it happened was is he ended up, he called it a fourth-rate imitation of The New Yorker, and it is. It's exactly like The New Yorker, and it's pretty hilarious, you know, down to the little drawings. And he hired a young man named Peter Matheson to be the literary editor. Mm-hmm. And so between, you know, him and Matheson, they concocted a new publication, which became the Paris Review. And Plimpton quickly came on. And of course, it's Plimpton who really made it last.
Well, the sense you get of Doc Humes is that he had a short attention span on the whole. He was a great idea man, but... then he'd move on to something else. And yet he wrote these two novels. Can you tell us a bit about them? Because one of them is, how many pages? It's got to be 800.
700 and something? Yeah, it's big. It is hefty.
750 pages. That's not the sort of thing that somebody who just has an idea and moves on will create.
Yeah, no, he did. He did work on those novels and finished those novels. He finished a few other things. But the books are pretty amazing. I mean, they came out in right at one after another. I mean, that's...
And they're very different.
They're extremely different. I mean, there's 1958, he comes out with The Underground City, which is this big, big, fat book, extremely ambitious sort of, you know, political novel. about the French Resistance and France and America before, during, and after the war. And, you know, as Ellen True says, it's a novel of ideas. It's really, you know, it's mythological in scope and political and psychological. And then right after that, in 1959, he comes out with this very slim, tiny, sharp little book novel called Men Die. Now, they're not so different in theme and subject. They both treat war and the apocalypse, whether it's the Nazi, you know, the Nazi genocide or, you know, the arms race. And many other sort of, many other themes indeed are shared. But the style of both, you know, they couldn't be more different.
And they both got great reviews. People declared him one of America's greatest writers. And then he didn't write anymore. Or he did, but really...
He never did, really. I mean, he really... He sold a third novel. And I found, in fact, when I was researching this film, I found all these scraps and pieces, you know, false starts and notes for the third novel. But he never got very far in it.
And you've said that you would hope to complete it for him?
Oh, that's a rumor. I am interested in trying to maybe do something with the film that he never finished.
Which we'll get to in a moment. But are you surprised that these novels have been out of print for so many years, considering the kind of response they had and the kind of people he hung out with? After all, some of the most important writers in America were his friends, at least for a time.
You know, I always took it for granted that they were forgotten. Growing up, they were sort of, when you're a kid, you know, you just, now it seems to me a miracle that they're back, even though I do believe, you know, that they more than deserve to be back. I'm thrilled that they're back, but.
One of them has an introduction by Alan Chews of NPR's All Things Considered. He has had a fair number of admirers over the years, and I would assume that people have tried to get these things published. When did you read them?
I read them first in my 20s, and then I read them recently, you know, reread them a couple of years ago. I was blown away both times. I did read them very differently, I have to say now. But
because you understand much more about him and where these things come from.
I don't know. The first time I read them, I was squeamish about the sex and all the women characters. Mm-hmm. I was much more critical, I think.
My guest... is Emmy Humes, who is the daughter of H.L. Humes, the author of The Underground City and Men Die, and also one of the most interesting characters of his time. The film will be playing at the Film Forum beginning tomorrow and running through the 29th. Do you see him as a victim of the counterculture because he dropped out of the literary scene, grew an unruly beard, started preaching the benefits of marijuana and healing massage?
A victim of the counterculture. A lot of people who knew and loved him in his younger days see him as a victim of Timothy Leary.
Mm-hmm. He was buddies.
Yeah, you know, good buddies with Timothy Leary, along with, you know, I mean, Doc was a very social guy and had a lot of friends. But Doc was very interested in psychedelics and all kinds of research into consciousness back there in the early 60s. And... So a lot of people, I mean, he did take this sort of heroic overdose of LSD at 1.65, which my mother thinks sort of seems to have kind of catalyzed some sort of or worsened mental illness that I think he always had.
A tendency toward paranoia, perhaps.
Well,
people have suggested that.
My sense is that he may have always been manic depressive or bipolar, like a lot of artists. And, you know, nobody really saw the depressive side except for my mom. But, you know, certainly everyone saw the manic, you know, the sort of wonderful creative manic sides.
He also tried his hand at filmmaking. He invented a paper house, but he tried his hand at filmmaking. The film is called Don Peyote, consciousness.
Right.
In your film, your father is compared to Don Quixote. So do you think he was really pushing that resemblance?
I know from his notes that he saw himself as a Don Quixote. And that he
tilting
identified.
At windmills?
Yeah, well, yeah. And I think he saw the Don Quixote figure as as the figure of the artist.
You know, he developed a lot of student followers. Did you have friends who were Docalites?
I did, indeed. Some of my best friends. But I was never a Docalite. None of my sisters were ever Docalites.
Well, what do you think his appeal to students was? Because it was, he had incredibly glib approach to the language. He could just spout all these things as though everything were fact, but a lot of it was kind of conspiracy theory.
Yeah, yeah. No, he had a wide range of raps. Part of my, you know, one of my greatest challenges in making the film, this is in his later years, of course. This is, you know, after the heroic mega dose of LSD, when he reinvented himself as a kind of, I call it a self-appointed visiting professor, when he, you know, he hung out on college campuses and kind of taught students.
Well, but, Paul also described him as the man who came to dinner and then stayed.
Right. Right. He was famous for moving onto a couch and never, ever, ever leaving, you know, for
months.
Unless
you told him to.
Well, unless you, you know, really worked at it. But I think that he had a tremendous number of different appeals for students. I mean, on the one hand, he was a grown-up who took them seriously and who, you know, they saw sort of extracurricularly and off hours, which at college, in college is not necessarily, which is a rare thing in college. Plus, he had this extraordinary background, you know, this sort of glittering past, and the students would dig up the books and read them and knew who he had been. And then he, you know, there is this sort of essence of the counterculture classic that Doc embodied. You know, all of his ideas were of the time in a way that it's maybe hard for me to articulate, but that... I think, you know, that's the appeal of those days.
What led you to think that there might be government reports on him? You pursued a freedom of information approach.
You know, I'm so glad. I just did a FOIA because, you know, for due diligence, because other people had done a Freedom of Information Act filings. His followers had previously done them and gotten pretty much nothing. So I just did another one just so that I could know that I'd done it. And I was very surprised, actually.
How much he was being watched.
Yeah,
I was
surprised
that they were watching him.
3 years after I filed it, I got this huge amount of paper in my mailbox one day. And it was mostly the FBI, but also the State Department and
But did they think he was
Force.
A danger?
I don't think so. I think it's that great, you know, it's a perfect illustration of the way that a secret government just, you know, perpetuates itself with no real reason. You know, that once a dossier is founded, you know, that then it just, it becomes a kind of perpetuating machine. And Doc certainly gave them, you know, he would bump up against the power structure and sort of challenge them. So he gave them reasons to continue following him. But it was never, I mean, it wasn't as if he was a communist or anything.
Emmy Hume's film, Doc, will be playing for 1 week at the Film Forum starting tomorrow. You might want to stop by and see it, this film about this fascinating man. Also, the two books that he had published, now available again in paperback editions. One is the first one, The Underground City, and then Men Die. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.